All right, so we're in Ephesians 5. We're going to be doing 1 through 14 here this evening, and it's this section of Paul's letter to the Ephesians, which we talked about a little bit a couple times ago, where in chapter 4, verse 1 through chapter 6, verse 9, 10, right around there, the whole framework of that passage in Paul's letter has to do with what does it look like to live the Christian life? And so he keeps using this language of walking, walking with God, and expressing our relationship with God in very specific ways. And the basic premise that Paul is operating out of is that for God to be in our lives, has got to create some kind of real, measurable, significant difference. People should be able to tell, man, there's something different about you, and that difference really points them to Jesus Christ. And so this is really what Paul's talking about, is what is it that God is trying to build into us, that revolutionary effect of his Spirit's indwelling in our lives? What does that look like? And where are our lives going as God continues to mold us and to shape us? And this evening we want to look at this passage. I've titled it The Heart of the Christian Walk, because in this paragraph, Paul really gets down to the central issue, what it's really all about. And I think that if we ponder what Paul is writing in this paragraph, really think about that, and think about our own lives in relation to what God is trying to accomplish in us, we take these principles and we begin to take them before the Lord and say, man, God, this is a picture of what I'd like to be. I think what we'll find is that God will really get a hold of us and begin to mold us and shape us and revolutionize our lives from the outside in. It's a very exciting passage. Let's take a look at it. Starting in verse 1, Paul says, therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children, and walk in love just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma. Then I'm going to switch down to verse 8. We'll get the middle verses here after a bit. And he says, you were formerly darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of the light. And so here, what is Paul saying? He begins by saying, be imitators of God as beloved children. And so what does it mean, really, to take action as believers in Jesus Christ? What is it that God really wants us to do? He's not saying, okay, here's a bunch of rules, here's a list of things, the do's and don'ts that I want you to get into. Now you go out there and you do those things. Not at all. The heart of Christian living is imitating God. And really the question that we want to get at when we think about how should I live my life? What are the things that ought to be driving me? What we're really saying is that we want to relate to other people the way that God relates to us. Okay? We want to relate to other people the same way that God relates to us. That's what it means to follow his example, to imitate God as his children. Now, what does that mean? What does that look like? And this is what Paul goes on to describe. He says in verse 2, walk in love. That's what it means to imitate God. God is love. And so if we're going to imitate him, what that means is that we're going to be people who more and more take on this central divine characteristic, this capacity to love. And then he says, too, walk as children of light. Now, the significance of these two imperatives, these are commands. These are things that Paul is telling this church, this is what you need to be about. What these things do are two things. One is that this command to walk in love really consolidates the substance of the Christian life. What's it really all about? What is God trying to form in me? What is God trying to do through me? How is he trying to shape and mold me? It's to be a person capable of love, just like God is love. And so that's the real substance of New Testament ethics. We wonder, you know, what is it that God wills for all people? It's love. When Jesus had his last night with his disciples in John 13, he says, guys, after he had stripped naked and washed their dirty feet with his clothes, he says, I've given this to you as an example, something to imitate. He said, I got a new command for you. And that is that you love one another. How? Just as I have loved you. So that's really the heart and soul of the whole thing. This is really what God is trying to accomplish in our lives. But this passage also points to the direction of the motivation to walk in love. You know, why should I? I have the sense that walking in love is not going to be an easy thing to do. Why should I do that? You know, if my standing before God under grace isn't at stake, then why should I walk in love? Why should I have a Christ-like view of people? Why should I relate to other people the way that God relates to me? And the motivation that Paul provides here, I think, is a very profound one. He says, walk as children of light. And we're going to come back to that in just a couple of minutes. But that's the motivation. The substance, walk in love. The motivation, to be lights, to walk as children of light. Now let's what we want to do tonight is we want to understand, what do these two commands mean? What do these imperatives relate to? And having understood them, then we want to apply them in concrete situations which Paul talks about in these verses between verse 2 and verse 8, verses 3 to 7. And so that's what we're going to do. That's where we're heading. Now, what does it mean to walk in love? Well, that's the real content of the Christian way of living. What kind of love does Christ have for us? If we're to walk in love just as Christ loved us, what does that look like? And how did Christ manifest his great love for us? Well, the text tells us. He gave himself up for us as an offering and a sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma. A sacrifice. So the love of Christ is sacrificial love. And this is, of course, pointing to the cross. And the idea here is that in the cross of Christ is the clearest demonstration of the nature and the extent of God's love for humanity. For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son. And how did he give him? He gave him as a sacrifice. For who? Well, you know, if you think about the scene at the cross, at the end of the Gospels, there's his mother and this band of disciples, and yes, he died for them. But then, too, there were other people at the scene, those who were mocking him, the ones who beat him beyond almost physical recognition, the ones who put the stakes in his hands and feet, the ones who put the sword through his chest. Well, he died for them too, voluntarily. He didn't have to die at any moment. Christ, because he's God, could have just pronounced judgment on the whole scene. But he didn't do that. And the love of God is, as Paul says, poignantly, I think, in Romans chapter 5, verse 10, he says that while we were yet enemies, Christ died for us. And so now we have a contentful picture of what does love really look like. It looks like the willingness, the capacity to sacrifice of our own lives for the real needs of other people. That's agape love. And Paul says in this passage that kind of love, because God is related to us like that, needs to then manifest itself in the way that we relate to other people. So like he says in the verse that just precedes this at the end of chapter 4, verse 32, he says, be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving each other, just as. See the continuity of thought there? See, God did this for you. Now you just turn around and as God in Christ also forgave you, you go and forgive other people. I just have to think that, you know, that is really the heart of things. This ability to forgive, the power to forgive. What is the clearest manifestation of our capacity to love other people? It's that we are willing to set aside the offenses that they've done to us, our willingness to relate to them independent of how they relate to us. That's the picture of the cross. And that needs to be a picture then of our own relationship. We need to, I made this point a couple of weeks ago. We come back to it here, and we're going to apply it again next week. What we think about relationships in our culture, well, human nature in general is this way. We think about our rights, and I choose somebody to relate to because I think, you know, we're going to have something mutually beneficial, and that's cool, that's good, that's fine. And so, but we have in our heads sort of a contractual way of thinking about things. I'll meet you halfway. If you do your part, I'll do my part. There's this type of thing. And that's not love. The New Testament, in talking about relationships that are rooted in God's love for us, interestingly, never even once talks about our rights in a relationship. The assumption is, of course your rights will be violated in relationship. But the real mark of a person who knows God is the person who's acting not on the basis of the rights that are due them, but their own understanding of the responsibility to continue initiating, to continue loving, regardless of what the other person is doing in response. Which doesn't mean, of course, that we're just a doormat and we allow ourselves to be trampled all over. No, earlier in Ephesians 4, Paul has said, you speak the truth in love. But the reason for it, see, of course, is different. So, your spouse has had a really bad day. And your spouse comes home and there you are. And you do something and it gets under their skin and they explode on you. I can't believe you did that. Stuff like that. Whoa! What do I do? Well, I may have to speak a word of correction. My dear husband or wife. I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but you're way out of line. Not because I deserve to be treated much differently than you're treating me, but do you see what you're doing to yourself? I'll speak the truth because I want their interests served, not because of the effect that it has on me. Well, this is exactly the example of Christ. It's my responsibility that I focus on. I don't think about what's wrong with them, how they need to change. I think about my life and what I need to do to continue moving towards them. Boy, if people had this in their heads, we would live in a very different world. If we had this in our heads, we would be a very different church. Okay? The petty offenses, resentments, things like that, that drive people up away from each other, which are true of every human institution, this is the only way to see that changed. That's the example of Christ. That's the distinctiveness of biblical love. That's the substance of the command to walk in love. Then Paul says, here's another, this idea of walking as children of light. And as the outline says here, the idea of light, it's a very common biblical metaphor. You see it all over the Old and New Testament. It relates to who God is. John tells us in 1 John 1:5 that God is light. And so we have the picture then of God standing, and in the Old Testament, God dwells in inapproachable light. To stand in the presence of God would be to be incinerated because God's moral perfection. We're not like Him, see. And so for an imperfect being to enter into the presence of God would be to be undone, to be destroyed. But in the New Testament, when we talk about salvation, what God has done for humanity, salvation in Christ, it's talked about in terms of light. In John 8, verse 12, Jesus says, I am the light of the world, and he who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life. And so central to the biblical message is that we are not born in right relationship with God, but rather that we're born in darkness, that we're shuffling around in the dark, that we're lost. And there are all kinds of descriptions that are very much like this all over the scripture. We know that we've got a problem. We know that we've got a problem that we can't fix. We're in darkness. We can't get the solution. And there is no human solution. And so when Jesus says that I've entered into the darkness, I took on human flesh, I became a man, so that I could give the light of life, what he is saying is that the real solution to man's problems cannot be resolved by man. They can only be resolved by God, by a restored relationship with him through Jesus Christ. Now, that's what he means by this imagery of the light, but it has a further application that I think relates in a direct way to this passage. The idea of light being a way of living that illuminates God to other people. God is light. Christ has come into the world as the light of life. And now we, as believers in Jesus Christ, are children of light, revealing. Just as light coming into a dark room, revealing the way things really are. Providing a way to bring people's lives together. And we do this in a couple of ways. First, by bearing witness to God through our testimony. That's a very important part of what we do. Peter says in 1 Peter 2, verse 9, he says, "You are a people of God's own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light." You know, Christians have found that coming into a relationship with God through Christ, having our sin paid for by him, having this awareness that, man, things are new and God is in my life, it's not something that you just sort of keep to yourself. Like, wasn't that interesting? We want people to know it. This is the greatest news that there possibly could be. And in this way, what we're doing with our testimony is saying to the people that we care for, that we love, there's something fantastic that's happened in my life. And I would love for you to check that out. And that's what we do. That's an important part of what we do. But also, we think in terms of demonstrating the reality of the gospel, not through our declaration, our verbal thing only, but also how we walk. That the way of living that the Bible describes here lends authenticity to the message that we speak. Now, what happens when your walk doesn't match your talk? Well, that's very ugly. That's hypocrisy. And when we bring these things together, God has changed my life. And we begin to see that manifested in real action that's consistent with that. That becomes a source of light to people that we are interacting with. It gives hope to people in darkness. Maybe there is a solution to the problems that I have in my life. Because I see this person over here, and they're dealing with problems that I know I have and that I have been able to relate to. I've been looking for change and can't find it. I see it in them. See? That's a very important part of our witness, our testimony to the world. How we live as children of light exposes the spiritual need that's resident in everyone who's apart from God. And this is what Paul says in verse 11 of this passage. Do not participate, he says, in the deeds of darkness, but expose them. Expose them. And so it is as we walk in the light that we are exposing the darkness, the sinfulness of the world around us. Now, I think about that, it sort of gives me the heebie-jeebies. Because what conjures up in my mind are images of, you know, advertisements on TV about how, you know, the corruption of American culture and how we need to turn to God or face his judgment. Or the self-righteous who are out there, you know, making it really clear that they've got their thing right together with God. What's wrong with you? And this type of thing. And so when we think about exposing the wickedness of our world, I think we come with a real disadvantage because we've got some bad examples out there. What does it mean to expose the darkness? Christ himself was very clear on this point. Not exposing darkness and alienation through our works of religious piety. Not that. Here's what Jesus says about the religious establishment of his day. He says, "Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them." To be noticed by them. You know, the holier than thou, I've got my life together, what about you types? The one who you just enter into the presence and immediately feel a sense of guilt. You ever had people in your life like that? I have. Christians can be really bad about this. And that's really not what we're talking about in this passage. We're not talking about exposing light, exposing the darkness in terms of condemnation either. That's not our job. Rather, it's to live as lights, as a contrast to darkness. Here's what Jesus says on the Sermon on the Mount. Same text that Matthew 6 comes out of. But in Matthew 5, verse 16, Jesus says, "Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good piety." No. "See your good works and glorify your Father that is in heaven." So it's as they see what you're up to, what the real substance of your life is about, that this sheds light in a dark world. And so the idea of being a light is very much tied then with the idea of walking in love, isn't it? It's demonstrating the love of God that gives light to people. No one is interested in becoming more pious. But what people are motivated by, I know what I have been motivated by, is to see real, tangible expressions of the love of God. Well, that's very inviting. And so what we want to do here is we want to bring these ideas together. And we want to ask this question, where does the contrast of love give light? What are the real points of emphasis, the real areas in which if we're practicing biblical love, if we're really walking in love, that love is going to serve as a source of light to lost people? That's the question that we need to address. This is the question that Paul takes up in those middle verses between the two imperatives. Look what he says in verse 3. He says, "Do not let immorality or impurity or greed even be named among you as is proper among the saints." So what we need to think about here is, what does love look like in a relationship context? And that's really what he's talking about here. Contrasting love to in the context of things that are closest to the heart. Immorality, it's the Greek word porneia, and it's related also to impurity. So that has, in this context, a distinctly sexual meaning, which means sexual immorality. This is one context in which the love of God is such a marked contrast to a world in darkness that it really does demonstrate the reality of the gospel. Let's think about that just for a minute, because our culture is very much like the culture of the Roman Empire. In the Roman Empire, when we think about sexuality, you know, pornia, that's where we get the word pornography. It has to do with sexual relationships outside of the context of permanent heterosexual monogamy. And, of course, that's something that in our culture today is just viewed as downright medieval, primitive. That we as an enlightened culture have gone way beyond our need for those antiquated taboos. And our culture today, just as the Roman world of the first century, when we think about sex, we don't think of it as a moral or a spiritual area at all. I have the urge. What should I do? Well, I should satisfy that urge. Of course I should. To not do so would be to in some way sacrifice my own humanity. And so we get into these porneia relationships where we're going around and we're basically wanting to use the body of another person to satisfy the urges that we really do have. Isn't that the way it is? I think that's the way it is. For the most part, it is just exactly this way. In our culture, when we think of sexual relationships, are we thinking about self-giving love? Like we talked about a minute ago, a laying down of my life to further the interests of that other person, irrespective of the consequences that it has for me? Or exploitation. I want to use your body without commitment to you, of course. When I'm done with you, I dispose of you just like I would any disposable item, like a Kleenex or something else. See, in our culture, we have utterly stripped sexuality of its moral content, its spiritual content, so that it's basically been reduced to the level of animalistic gratification of drives. I don't think that's an exaggeration. I don't think that's an exaggeration. And there's something profound that happens. And most of you know what I'm talking about here. There's something profound that happens when our sexual relationships are porneia. And that is that it erodes real bonds between people. It erodes trust. Boy, I have the privilege of working with wonderful people in my home group. And I'm on, I don't know how many of these groups we've planted over the years. One thing that I just see time after time after time again, couples coming together, falling in love, getting married, and then dealing in the first few years of their lives with the extraordinary levels of damage that they have brought into that relationship through their relationships of the past, where they have allowed themselves to be used, where they've used the other person without commitment at all. And it's devastating. And to build real trust and to learn how to sacrifice in a significant way for that other person is a very difficult transition for people to make. You know what I'm talking about? This is really at the heart of working with people in our culture. Sex is an intrinsically moral thing. It is an absolute coming together of two people to give your body to another. I was talking to a guy last week from Cuba, a Cuban, and he's lived most of his life there. He was kicked out when Castro came to power, but he, as a Cuban citizen, he goes back pretty often. And we were talking about cultural differences between Cuba and America, and he made this one point that I thought was pretty profound. He said, you know, in Cuba, when a kid is 12 years old, they take him out of the family and they put him into these boarding schools. And the purpose of the boarding school is not just for the sake of education, but also for the sake of indoctrination, and they want to learn how to control people. They want docile servants of the state. And so they set up their dormitories intentionally as a co-ed, barely supervised setup. And of course, you know, away from home, between 12 and 18 years old, co-ed dorm, what do you think's going on there? A whole lot of porneia. And that's exactly what the state wants. That's the point. They want people to have lost the capacity for real, deep, intimate relationships with others so that they can control them. They understand this biblical insight that Paul is here describing. There's a real power that comes with committed love relationships, where people really do sacrifice for one another, where we really are able to be instruments of God for effective change in another person's life, where the question of trust and commitment doesn't even have to arise, because of course I'm committed to you, regardless of the failings that you inevitably will show in this relationship. We're going to talk about that at length next week and the week after, because Paul, in this passage, goes on in the second half of chapter 5 to talk about marriage, and then at the beginning of chapter 6 to talk about parenting. Wow, what a profound source of light this becomes to a world lost in darkness, a world that views sexuality as just one other animalistic urge to be satisfied. It's a profound thing. Victorious, committed love is light, and we're going to show how that is. Well, then there's another thing that Paul talks about here. He talks about greed. Greed, pleonexia. That is the compulsion to have more. More stuff, newer stuff, better stuff. And according to the scriptures, this is not love. That money is a moral and is a spiritual issue. Boy, in our culture, it's sure not that way, is it? We have this very prosperous economy, and we operate under the assumption that if I earn it, then it's mine. And I can do with it just whatever I want to do. And pleonexia is kind of works with this. You've got some good stuff. Too bad it's used. You need to go out and get yourself some more. And some more. And some more. And some more. And I mean, our whole economy is based on this, isn't it? Consumer economy. It's based upon pleonexia, the demand that I must have more stuff. And this, Paul says, is not love. It is a sick and unloving compulsion that ruins families, that takes the best years of people's lives. For what? To have more? John D. Rockefeller was once asked, you know, here's one of America's first billionaires, Mr. Rockefeller, how much is enough? To which he said, just a little more. Just a little more. And so the compulsive nature of seeking wealth, seeking your identity, seeking your value and significance from the things that you can go out and purchase is a dead-end street. I really like what Paul told Timothy in 1 Timothy 6, verses 7 to 9. He says, we have brought nothing into the world, and so we can't take anything out of it either. And if we have food and covering, with these we shall be content. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. And people are destroying their families and destroying their lives because they have this compulsive need to achieve, defined in material terms. That's not love. Paul says earlier in this passage, at the end of chapter 4, he says, you know, what do I do with my money? He says, I work so that I might meet the needs of those who are in want. That's the that's what love motivates us to do, to work. Not to have more for me, but to have enough so that I can share and really meet the needs of other people. To really sacrifice in the financial area, because I know. Now think about this. Americans are about 5.5% of the world's population. Do you think everyone lives like we do? Of course not. Of course not. Go to almost anywhere in the continent of Africa. Go almost anywhere in Asia, and you will see the majority of the population barely a few calories above malnutrition. He who has the world's goods, John says in 1 John 3, and beholds his brother in need and turns his heart from his brother, John says, how does the love of God abide in that man? There's a real accounting that's going to have to be done by the American church before God for having the vast treasures that we possess and a lack of heart for lost, struggling, and dying people. How you handle your money is a big witness. You know, one of the things that has been helpful for my wife and I and our family is that we're pretty open about our money with our kids. And so they don't get stuff sometimes like their friends do. You know, I'm 16 now, my son tells me. Where's my car? I say, well, I don't know. Where'd you put it? You think that because you live in Westerville and you're 16, that somehow gives you the right to have a car? No, it doesn't at all. I didn't have a car until I was out of college.
You what?
Times have changed. I want my children to know that there are limitations of what we will provide for them because we are committed to meeting real needs of other people outside of our family, and that means they're just not going to get some stuff. They've got to see it. They've got to understand that the way that we view our possessions as children of God is different than the attitudes that make up the outlook of our neighbors. Not that we walk around, God, I gotta give again. I gotta give. What a drag. Oh man, it's a real joy. It's a joy to know that what we give is making a difference in people's lives. It's really cool. Why would you deprive your kids of that? You know? Why would you do that? And so to be able to have contentment in your life, real contentment, the ability to say, you know, I don't really need a lot more stuff. You know, that's a very powerful thing. You can live with a whole lot less. That's a witness. Think about that. Well, Paul goes on. Here in verse 4, here's another point of contrast. There must be, he says, no filthiness or silly talk or coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather the giving of thanks. I think our translators are on acid here. Iskrotes. That sounds kind of filthy, doesn't it? Iskrotes. I was thinking about that. I guess that is sort of fitting. Is translated here, filthiness. And so here is this, in this verse, are things that relate to how we verbally communicate with other people that are important. And this is dealing with obscenity. Obscenity would be a much better translation than filthiness. Demeaning speech, and I don't think he means cuss words here, although that could in some contexts include that, but it rather has to do with speech, with genres of humor, things like that, that are obscene in the sense that they demean people. You know what I'm talking about. There was an interview I saw a couple of years ago with Bill Cosby, which I thought was really good. And Cosby was commenting, he's really the first enormously, globally important African-American comic. Well, at least in our generation, right? And he was talking about some of these other guys who are coming up and how they indulge in a lot of really graphic and sometimes foul sexual humor. And you know, Cosby was really cool about it. He says, you know, some of that stuff is funny. There's just no, you can't ignore that. It's funny. But he says, I feel as though I have a responsibility in my humor to communicate my race to this culture. And so I won't go that way. You don't have to go, hey, that guy's really hilarious. You know, and much more creative than the other guys. But the reason that he gave is the biblical reason that Paul is getting at here. Because who does that point to? See, that's what he's talking about. Don't get into the Iscrotes scene. Morologia. This is what's translated here, silly talk, and this is what elicited my comment about the translator being on acid. You might get the idea that Paul is saying that jokes are bad, that a spiritual person is a humorless person, that, you know, silliness is somehow sinful. But that's not what Paul is saying here at all. Morologia, well, you know, the word moros is the root here. That sound familiar to you? Moros? It's where we get the word moron from. Okay, and so what he's saying is that don't talk like a moron. Moronic raving. People who just cannot find it within themselves to talk about anything of depth or of personal significance at all, whose whole way of interacting with people is in the banal and the superficial and the trivial and in the inane. He's not saying be humorless, like jokes aren't funny. He's saying don't be a moronic raver. Don't be one of these people who just, you know, can never get it together to say anything contentful or that speaks to the real interests of other people around them. 20th century media, I'm convinced, will go down as a monument of banality. And it really speaks to the moral fiber of our culture. It's a reflection of it. And it's empty. And so Paul is saying here, don't do that. Have something valuable to say. Coarse jesting. Eutrypelia. That's close. The idea of coarse jesting is the razor-sharp barbs that people direct towards each other. That's what he means there. And this, I think, is very significant. The whole idea of personal put-downs. You know, this is how we jockey for position socially. It's by slamming the other person, you know, to somehow ingratiate ourselves before other people. And words are very powerful things. And some of us today can remember things said to us 30 and 40 years ago. That shaped our whole sense of who we were. We have a saying in our house, my wife and I, as veterans of many arguments, we say, some things must never be said. And, you know, sometimes when I'm interacting with young couples and I hear the kind of blowouts that they have and the kinds of demeaning things that they say to each other, it makes me want to weep. How will you ever get over that? And so that's really important. Words are power. And we can use words to just, in a sentence, in a phrase, in a word, we can reduce someone to rubble. That's what the world's really good at. Or, as Paul says here, not that stuff. It's just not fitting. It's not appropriate for a child of God to view other people in that way. But rather, he says, the giving of thanks. He's going back to grace, isn't he? It's grace that shapes the way that we speak to people. Not what are your bizarre idiosyncrasies that I can rub in your face and make you feel like a loser. But in what way do you manifest in who you are the person of God as his child? There's a lot to be said here. This is an important area. But we need to move on and draw things to a close. Paul says in verses 5 and 6, he says, "For this you know with certainty that no immoral or impure person or covetous man who is an idolater," that's interesting, covetousness, that is the desire for more, he associates here with idolatry, an idol, "has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience." Whoa! The purpose of walking in the light and walking as light, the purpose of biblical love expressed in ways that people can observe, is to expose by contrast the way that people live. And to help them see that they're in desperate need of forgiveness, desperate need of the grace of God. The way that we should live, by contrast, shows, man, you've got a problem with God. That you view people as opportunities for self-interest and exploitation. That you're the kind of person who will just demean somebody into oblivion just for your own kicks. That's some real sick stuff. You've got a problem. But it's not a problem with me. Problem with God. You know, it's important that we understand here. God is not asking you to change your life before you come to Him. He knows that you're in darkness. He knows that you're scratching around to try to find some answers. That's why you're here tonight. Don't try to fix yourself some kind of a mid-year resolution. I'm going to be better. Talk about with God what he's talking about here in this passage. God, I hear that you died for me, that that's how much you love me, that it's possible for me to become one of your children. I'd like that. I'd like to walk in the light. I'd like to put this past behind me and to have something new and to have a relationship with you. And that God is super into doing, and he wants to come into your life. And the good news of the gospel is that we're not meeting God halfway. We're not working our way to God. We're simply coming before him and saying, I want the gift of Christ's death to apply to my life. And in the moment that you do that, God will declare you right in his sight because of what Christ has done for you. The moment that you do that. But don't think about cleaning up your act first. I don't want us to think that somehow what Paul is saying here, that this us and them thing, is that somehow Christians are perfect. Oh, far from it. I was reflecting on the many abuses of the tongue this afternoon and thought, "Doo!" Well, you know, and there's other stuff there too. Christians are far from perfect, and that's not the point of this passage. I like what Paul says here. He says, you were darkness, but now you are light. What is that? Those are verbs that deal with, you know, that you were and that you are, that deal with who I am. Who I am, not what I do. And that's how God views us. Are we sinful? Of course we are. Do we make the same, we have the same sort of hang-ups that people in the world do? Of course we do. This passage is not suggesting that somehow that we're perfect and other people are not. Far from it. Far from it. It's just that God has granted us the right to become his children. And because we are his children now, we stand in a different relationship to those problems in our life. I think one of the clearest pictures in my mind of how that's worked itself out, that idea of God dealing with us as in terms of our identity as his children. It came to me, this has been 10 years ago or more than that now, in an event where my wife was reaching out to this woman who had spent from age 16 to age 30 in prison. She had was cranked up on dope and was involved in the accidental but and senseless death of a child. And so she grew up institutionalized in a 6x8 cell. And at 31 was shock paroled. And so she was forgiven by the state at that point. And she has a new identity. And now she's not prisoner of the state number, whatever number she was. She's a person with a name and address and identity, which is really kind of sweet. But, you know, it's funny. My wife, after she had moved in, went over to visit her. She's got one of these, you know, one-room, bedroom apartments, you know, little dining room, little living room, a kitchen, a bedroom, a bathroom. She walks in, and she noticed something kind of bizarre. There was no furniture in the apartment. Not in the dining room, not in the living room, not in the kitchen. And then she goes into the bedroom. And everything that this woman belonged had been jammed into a 6x8 little area. Why'd she do that? She's a free woman. She doesn't live in a cage anymore. But she had just conditioned herself to view herself this way, to live this way, and she had to discover over painful months what it meant to live as a free person, as a person who's been forgiven, as a person with a new life. And that's really the way it is with respect to these things. And a lot of us, we've got problems in these areas. And God deals with you on the inside. You are his child. You have been paroled. And he's going to help you learn how to live in this new apartment that he's given to you. Not because you're perfect, but because he has declared you innocent. He's justified you on the basis of what Christ has done for you. So this passage, I think, is a plea for consistency, for the sake of witness, and for the sake of our own wholeness before God. Last point I want to make here very briefly, and this is that when we think about being lights to the world, again, I think we get some bad examples of what that means in our culture. Examples that Paul and Christ himself would have been offended by from the church. We need to keep the light where it belongs. When is the light effective? It's dark. How many of us turn our porch light on during the day? Of course you don't do that. The significance of light is that it has an effect on darkness. And so Paul says in verse 7 in this text, he says, do not be partakers with them. Not don't associate, don't partake. The idea that somehow Christians would distance themselves from the impurities of the world so that they could do their Jesus thing is just absolutely contrary to the whole thought frame of the Bible. Of course we should be in the world. I like what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5, verse 10. He says, I did not mean to not associate with immoral people of this world. He says, for then you would have to be taken out of the world. Of course not that. Of course not that. We need to be where the people are who need the light. This is what Jesus says in the high priestly prayer of John 17, the last recorded prayer before the cross. I do not ask, and he's praying to the Father on behalf of his disciples. I do not ask that you take them out of the world. Of course not. That's why they're here. That's why you're here. Don't buy the fundamentalist line in America today that says, be ye separate. Do not associate with, you know, really screwed up people. Because that's just not God's way. And who was it that Christ hung out with? All the losers. Quite a resume of his friends. And that's the way that we should be as well. That's how we'll be light. That's where the love of God, as he works that out in our life, is going to be a real beacon of hope for the people around us. So there you have it. Next week, we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about the application of this idea of walking in love with respect to marriage. We're going to spend a couple of weeks on marriage. I hope you can handle that. Because Paul has some pretty important things to say about that. Things that we really need to hear, not just in this culture, but in this church. We're out of time, so why don't we pray together. God, we just do want to present ourselves to you, realizing that really at the heart of your will for our lives is that we relate to people the way you relate to us. And sometimes it's difficult to know what that looks like. Most of the time, God, it's really right before our face, and we know that it's in the important relationships that you bring into our lives, where you're calling on us to love, to lay down our lives, that love is manifested and that produces the light of hope, that you really do change lives, and that often opens the door to more significant spiritual searching on the part of people who are really without the tools to deal those things. Amen.